is also actively involved in forming a clinical trials consortium in Tourette syndrome. This network is actively involved in evaluating pharmacologic and behavioral interventions for children and adults with Tourette syndrome. Dr. Scahill received her master's degree in psychiatric nursing and a doctorate in epidemiology at Yale University. He joined the faculty of the Child Study Center in 1989, was appointed assistant professor in 1997, associate professor in 2000, and professor in 2006. He serves on the medical advisory board of the Tourette's Syndrome Association and on the editorial board of many journals. He's an author of co-author of over 200 articles on autism, Tourette's, ADHD, and obsessive compulsive disorder. And I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Scahill for having the foresight to approach us at Pfizer even before we had the autism unit with an innovative idea of evaluating the effects of anti-anxiety medications in patients with autism. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate you all, the holy remnant here, staying to the bitter end. You must be very interested in this topic, and I'm very glad of that. This will be a very different talk. I'm a bit of a sleuth. I'm very interested in identifying compounds that can treat target problems in autism and in Tourette syndrome and the like. So my bend on this is how do we get to measuring targets that we think are important. We can have a great insight that this is an absolutely useful target, and you've heard today that anxiety, and there are many posters here at the meeting that anxiety is common and adds to the despair and disability of children with autism, but we are a ways away from measuring it. So what I'll do is take you on a bit of an inspection of how we might be able to go about that. It's typical to give disclosures. I've served as a consultant in the past few years with Shire, Neurosearch, Boehringer Ingelheim, Pfizer, and Hoffman Roach. These are companies that have paid attention to autism and also Tourette, and I'm very happy that they're interested because they have compounds that should be of interest to us that in some cases not yet on the market. Most of my research funding comes from the government, Tourette Syndrome Association, and some pharmaceutical support. So some questions that I'd like you to think about as we go through this. I'm not going to say we're going to answer all these, but how common are anxiety disorders in children and adolescents with autism spectrum disorder? And are some anxiety disorders more common than others? Important question that I don't think we'll answer. Does anxiety look the same in children with autism spectrum and typically developing youth? Should we be thinking more about dimensions rather than categories? Is there an overlap between anxiety and ASD? In other words, sometimes we use this perfectly awful word called comorbidity, as if there's some amount of disability conferred by this thing over here and some additional morbidity conferred by something over there. But it might be, if we were a little smarter, we would understand that there's a blend. Perhaps there's a subgroup of children with autism that have anxiety as part of that syndrome. So it's not a co-anything. It's a single thing. Are there differences by IQ? Because there are important differences in measurement by IQ. So it'd be very useful to figure that out if we can. So there's nice papers out. There's a nice paper from David Evans. I don't know if David's here, but he's been here at the meeting. And he did a simple kind of survey of parents and found out that children with autism spectrum have lots of fears. And we all know, in fact, I usually use this as part of my clinical interview, is how does the kid do at the barber shop? And if these kids can make it to the barber and it's not a big event, that kid's probably not going to be too anxious. But many of these children can't go to the barber, can't go to the dentist. So they have lots of fears. And this is something that parents have been telling us about for a while. Could we say that these things in the bottom of the slide are manifestations of anxiety? They're protest in change in routines. You've heard it a million times. The kids won't let the mother turn right out of the driveway. They got to turn left, and I don't think it's a political statement. It's just got to be that way. Reluctance in new situations. These children are often, you know, got back up against the wall in birthday parties and the like. Protest and separation from parents. We have some parents that have not gone out to dinner in many months because it's such a big deal. Avoid social situations. This is something that we see probably a little bit more in the teenage kids who are, you know, maybe thinking about venturing out, but it's an anxiety producing. Excessive tension and restlessness. This is something that parents have told us about. It'd be nice to know more about it. So this slide comes from a wonderful review that I recommend my former postdoc and now assistant professor down in Virginia, Susan Williams-White. She just did this exhaustive review published a couple years ago. And these are the five studies that had the largest N's, and that's why I put them up here. There's the citation if you want to dig it up. And these are all from clinical samples. So we say up front there's possibility for ascertainment bias here. But what you see here is age range, some variation, but they're children. And what you see is high rates of anxiety. Now, they use very different methods of assessing these anxiety symptoms. I'm not saying that any of these are right, but they all show fairly similarly that there is an elevated amount of anxiety disorder or anxiety symptoms in children with autism spectrum disorder. Some of them made it clear that several children had anxiety symptoms in more than one diagnostic category. Very important point. We see this in typically developing children with anxiety as well. But when we look at the rate, say, in the Dutch study, De Bruin, 55%, there are many children that had more than one disorder. So next couple of slides are from my current postdoc, Victoria Hallett. I see her out there. And these are really cool data. Her dissertation is from the twin study in England, started by Robert Plowman, who many of you will recognize as a leading twin researcher in the world. And so Tori got access to a set of twin pairs where they screen positive for at least one of the twins screen positive for an autism spectrum disorder. So there were 128 twin pairs where at least one of them screened positive. And you can see the IQ, and I want you to note that most of them had IQ above 70. Controls matched from the same twin registry, and they fussed around until they could get a unaffected twin pair where they had some sampling of kids with IQ less than 70, though 85% greater than 70. Mean age is 13 and a half years, 86% male. And so then they took the kids who screened positive and they looked closely at their diagnostic using the typical ADI, ADOS, and then they were assigned to autism spectrum disorder, a broad spectrum, near diagnostic categorization but not there, and unaffected. Controls, because they screened negative, were not further evaluated for ASD, but they were evaluated for anxiety. So this is a measure that they use. This is a measure that was first developed by Spence and revised by Bruce Chorpita, and I think it's probably a good measure. I don't know it in detail. So these are Z-scores now. These are not actually diagnoses, but these would probably be highly correlated with the diagnosis. And these are the parents filling out this anxiety measure scored from 0 to 3, and you can see across the bottom that they're in diagnostic categories. But again, this is not exactly a diagnosis. And dramatic differences in the twins affected with ASD compared to the unaffected sample of twins the same age, matched on gender, and more or less on IQ. These are really dramatic differences. And what I notice here is that first, total anxiety, so taking a score across all disorders, separation anxiety, very high. Obsessive compulsive behavior, we would probably expect that, but generalized anxiety is also very high. And these are the kids. The differences are not as dramatic, and we could talk for a while on how to think about self-report in kids who have deficits in their evaluating their own behavior. But the trend is pretty similar. So initial conclusions for the moment. I think it's fair to say that youth with ASD, and I don't know if I emphasized it enough, that that twin sample came from the community. Many of them probably were in a clinic somewhere, but it was not a clinic ascertained sample. So both in clinic samples and in this twin sample, kids with ASD are at higher risk for anxiety disorders. The most common appears to be simple phobia. I didn't go into that, but if we just set that aside for a minute, social phobia, separation anxiety, GAD look like fairly common. Many kids have more than one anxiety disorder. Given that, I'm going to suggest that we start thinking more dimensionally rather than categorically, especially if we're talking about inclusion criteria for a medication study and an outcome. The next few slides have to do with some work that we've done from secondary analysis of our RUP sample. Now, the RUP has conducted three large-scale multi-site trials, and we collected lots of data, and now we've been mining these data to try to see what we can understand. One of the measures that we used was a 132-item measure developed by Ken Gatow and Joan Sprafkin. It's a DSM-4-based measure scored from 0 to 3. It covers the waterfront of DSM-4 disorders. 26 of those items relate to anxiety. So we thought we could try to mine those data and see what we could learn. We looked closely at the 26 items, and we decided after discussion to drop 6 of them. A couple had to do with PTSD. A couple had to do with OCD that we're measuring elsewhere. A couple had high overlap with ADHD, so we dropped those two. That left 20 items. And if you read under the bullet point, you could see that they're not equally covering anxiety disorders. They're kind of going across the disorders. Maybe if I had the chance, I would have had a different admixture of anxiety disorders represented, but those are the data that we had. So it's scored from 0 to 3, each item, which, so for 20 items, you could have a score from 0 to 60. So our plan was to look at the scores across the four multi-site studies that we've done, including the RUP and START studies. And then we're going to look closely at two studies that we did with our RUP data. So take a minute to stare at this slide. You see what the studies were on the left column, the sample sizes, the age range, the target symptoms. So none of these were targeting anxiety. They were not ascertained for that reason. Over 80% male, as you would expect. The percentage of children diagnosed with autism, and the last column is the rate of children with IQ less than 70, so in the intellectually disabled category. And you see there's big differences, especially with the risperidone study and the citalopram study, which was focused on repetitive behavior. So we have lots and lots of data. I'm presenting this one slide to give you a feel for how this CASI 20-item anxiety scale maps to some of these other very familiar measures that you probably know. the aberrant behavior checklist. The aberrant behavior checklist, I'm showing here four subscales: irritability, social withdrawal, stereotypy, and hyperactivity. I put the red circles around the citalopram study to point out that that sample looks pretty different. That sample, they were recruited for repetitive behavior. So they are apparently lower in anxiety, which we were a little surprised at. We thought that possibly repetitive behavior and anxiety would go together. Doesn't appear to be so. They're lower in irritability. We were not at all surprised at that. That's tantrums, aggression, self-injurious type behavior. They're lower in social withdrawal. The social withdrawal scale, time allowed, we could tell a whole story about that. But we're starting to wonder how much connection there might be with anxiety and social withdrawal. Social withdrawal on this scale has to do with the extent to which a person responds to initiated interaction by another person and the extent to which they initiate interaction on their own. So if you just kind of wander through this with your eyes, Kevin can probably take some pictures and see what's lighting up. No. What you'll see, though, is that there really isn't any real pattern here. There's no sense that the anxiety scale is mapping so easily. As soon as you think you might see something, another column will show you that it doesn't really map. Now, for a person like me, that's good. That means that it's measuring something different. It's not measuring any of these things. So now we look at some of the basic psychometrics of it in two samples from RUP trials where we had the raw data available to us and we could shake it up and look at it. On this 20-item scale, we see a so-called internal consistency very high. This means that the scale behaves in a coherent sort of way. The mean score in the sample published a couple years ago and another sample serving as a replication is, you can read it off there. Remember, it can go from 0 to 60. So I don't know if these are high scores or not. The range is quite wide, 0 to 42 and 0 to 50. The last row is something that I hope I can make clear. So this is scored from 0 to 3. And that means I could take everybody in this room, get their score, and I could make a per item mean. And if everybody was bad on one of these items, you'd have a per item mean of 3. If you were next to nothing on it, you'd have a per item mean of 0. So you can see a very wide per item mean here. That means that presumably some items are contributing more to the score than others. We're getting very interested in that. What about correlations? Again, we could talk a long time about this, but I think you can look at this and say the correlations with common measures that we use are not very high. They're not very high. The highest one we see here is 0.36. That's not a very high correlation. It might be significant statistically, but it's not meaningful. Again, this suggests that the measure is measuring something different. Incidentally, I'm not showing the data, but there's no significant difference in kids above and below IQ 70. So we took a look at these items, and we looked at the items that were the top 7. And these were the top 7 in both samples. And the order actually was very similar. So I just would encourage you to read these. And what do you see here? First of all, their behaviors, except for the inference about tension and relaxation and unable to relax. These are things that people can generally see. And this is a parent measure. So that I would say that I would call these pretty believable, and the parents are endorsing them. And these are not children that were ascertained for the purposes of anxiety. These all had per item means greater than one. Oops. And these are the bottom six. Again, these are the bottom six in both samples. And their per item mean is less than 0.4. That means that they're not being endorsed very often. And I want you to look at these with an eye toward what they represent. They represent a fair high degree of inference on the part of the parent. They're making judgments about the worry. They're making, if the kid's not verbal, they're not going to be complaining about heart pounding. Does it mean they don't have heart pounding? No. It just means that it's not something the parents can easily endorse if the kid doesn't say so. Worries about some disaster. Nightmares. Well, if the child has minimal verbal capacity, they're not going to be able to describe nightmares. So it didn't surprise me when I looked closely at this that these ended up to be the items not often endorsed. So what about social anxiety? When we first started in this work, we thought there was going to be a real connection between anxiety and social anxiety, particularly in higher functioning kids. So, and this is sort of what some of our thoughts were, that the kids with even though only a vague awareness of their social disability might then greet social interaction with more anxiety. Kind of made sense. Repeated failure in social interaction, one could say, could easily promote avoidance. It's not going so good. That's almost aversive to me, to be in those kind of situations. I'm not going to do it. And the presence of social anxiety, if any of the first two are right, would amplify social avoidance and social disability, because even if they're interested, they're not putting themselves in the situations where they can benefit from interaction and become better at it. So that caused me to take a look at social anxiety. And I collected data on 103,800 people. And if you believe that, I got... No, this was a 20-country survey done by the World Health Organization. And it's, the first author is Dan Stein from South Africa. It's a really cool paper if you want to take the time to look at it. Their interest was, are there differences in social anxiety in developing and non-developing countries? And that's interesting, but it wasn't exactly my interest in looking at these data. I was interested in this. If you go to DSM-4, you'll see that there are essentially two parts to social anxiety. On the right are performance items. The kids who are afraid to eat in the cafeteria because they don't like to see, they don't want people to see them eating. The person who is avoidant of public bathrooms because it's anxiety producing. People who don't want to be watched while they're writing. And so performance-based issues. This, incidentally, was not endorsed very often in our 20-item scale, and I don't think that's a surprise. The other is the interaction items, and these are items that we think, look more relevant to autism spectrum disorder. And what they showed in this really large sample of 103,000 people from 20 countries is these break out as factors. They break out as factors. And I'm willing to put my money down to say the interaction items are factors of greater interest to us in autism spectrum disorder. So what about IQ? And what about some correlations with measures of social interaction? So, again, we had two samples, one we published on a couple years ago. Okay, thank you. A couple years ago, and one that my graduate student just finished a couple weeks ago. And again, we could go over each and every box, but the point here is straightforward. There's not high correlation with the CASI 20-item anxiety scale with any social measure that we have available. and it doesn't seem to matter that much by IQ. So the good news in that is that it's possible that we could identify an anxiety measure, parent-graded, that cuts across IQ. So tentative conclusions. The anxiety scale shows orderly distribution across IQ. It has solid internal consistency, which is sort of a reliability 101. It appears to be measuring a separate construct. Social anxiety, unfortunately, is not well covered. Separation anxiety, out of 20 items, there are 8 items of separation anxiety, and we now know that many of them are not very often endorsed. 6 items have very low endorsement and could probably go. It's unclear if it's sensitive to change, but we need to test that. Overall conclusions, anxiety disorders appear common in ASD. GAD, separation and social anxiety, appear to be most common. The asterisk is to point out that social anxiety appears to be variable depending on the sample and the method used to define it. Dimensional approach fits best for treatment trials. Now, I'm saying that's a conclusion. That's not really true. That's an opinion. But I'm sticking to it because I think it's the right approach. Unanswered at the moment is a co-occurrence versus an ASD subtype. I'm not so sure I'm thinking about this as a co-occurrence phenomenon. I'm thinking about this, that this is a problem for perhaps a large subgroup of children with ASD. Anxiety in ASD versus typically developing youth, I don't think we know the answer to that. I think it would be a good thing to find out. There's one paper on that I could find, but it didn't really separate the water for me. I think we need to know more about differences in IQ. And we better do it fast, because according to this guy, we got a week to figure this out. 1 week. I give my thanks to especially my postdocs. I've had this wonderful luck to have these 4 names up there, Karen Bears, Victoria Hallett, Dennis Holdowski, and Susan Williams-White, psychologist postdocs over the last 12 years or so. Contributed a lot. The 2 graduate students, the RUP investigators, the START investigators, and our NIH colleagues that were part of these enterprises. Thank you.
Excellent, Larry. Thank you so much. Do we have any questions for the end of the session?
Eric.
So would you recommend using the, 7 endorsed items of the CASI as a rating scale?
No, and I'm glad you asked that. I really appreciate that. I went through that whole enterprise to sort of try to figure out which ones we could drop more than which ones that we would totally depend on. Because what I'd like to do is add some additional items, particularly in the social anxiety domain. And maybe grow it back up to, say, 15 items, something like that. But the 6 that were rarely endorsed, it'd be nice to look at another sample to make sure that it just wasn't something peculiar about those 2 samples. But I think there's a good reason that they were not often endorsed.
Any other questions? If not, thank you so much, everyone. This has been the end of an exciting session and a great meeting. So thanks so much for coming, and safe travels.